We started off with master pianist, composer, and arranger Ray Holman from Trinidad, my country. That's Charlotte Street. That's from his 2003 album, Ray Holman in Touch. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lee. It is Friday, July the 18th. Free Your Mind Friday here on Lead Stories. And as you know, that means the program belongs to you. It's an open forum where you bring your ideas and opinions and analyses of the issues of the day. And it is time, usually it is time very well spent. So let's keep that tradition going today as well. 888-874-4888 is a number to call, and let's get started. From California, Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, more than wonderful, Eutrice.
Oh, my goodness. You promoted me today.
Absolutely. You are great. You are absolutely great. I appreciate you very much. Since this is Free for All, Free Your Mind Friday,
yes.
I'd like to discuss the fact that we're multidimensional beings. And I believe we have one foot in the physical and the other foot in the metaphysical. And the Aboriginal people of Australia talk about the dream time as real. They claim it's as real as waking reality. And my theory is that I believe that when we fall asleep at night, that we go holographically, that means all at once, through the eye at the center of the black hole at the nucleus of every atom in our body, into the dream time. That's why when people are woken up suddenly, they say, oh, I'm not all here yet. And I think that the fact is that perhaps we have it all wrong. You know, we think of living here and then we die. But the truth is that we may actually live in the dream time and project into waking reality. And it's like a hand going into a glove, like we're the puppet made of the earth and star material and whatever we're made of. And we live our life. And then when the body is tired, we pull out once again through the eye, the center of the black hole, the nucleus of every atom, into the dream time. That's the porthole into the dream time. It's not on the outside, it's on the inside. And that's where we really are. So perhaps when we die, it's like every day we go into waking reality, into waking reality, into waking reality. But the time we die, we just don't go in, you know, that day the disconnection is made, and we're just safe back in the dream time. The body rejoins the earth, and we sort of wait for the next ride. Start again. So I think that's a kind of reality that might exist. Nothing is for real. Nothing is for sure. But I, you know, based on physics as we know it, and the possibility that there's a black hole, the nucleus of every atom, which not only is in my mind the porthole into dream time, but provides the gravity that binds the proton neutron center and the electrons in the orbital shell around the proton neutron center. So this is like a porthole as well as a gravitational force, the spin of the black hole at the center of every atom. So that's my theory, and I'll stand by it.
Well, thank you. Well, you got us started. You can be counted on to get us decidedly cosmic, that we contemplate very deep things, multidimensional deep things. Thank you so much, Harvey, for getting us started today. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air. How are you doing today?
Greetings, Eutrice. How are you?
Thank you. Fine, thanks. How are you doing?
Eutrice, I'm up here. I need to get my grass skirt because I heard you were playing some soca music, but not quite soca. But I missed Carnival by about, 4 or 5 months, so.
That's
I guess
all. Nobody actually is ever late for Carnival. Whenever you want to show up, it's just fine.
You're right, Eutrice, because it's over season right now in Barbados, so I'm still in the mode. But
that's true.
But Eutrice, thank you for your program and greetings once again. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and so the same extent to the PRN listening audience as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, ma'am. What I wanted to free my mind about today is on two topics. One of it has to do with the conflict ongoing right now in Palestine, where Israel has been given a free green light to go ahead and ethnic cleanse over there. And the United States is hemming and hawing, and they're talking about two-state solution and all this other sort of foolishness about, you know, peace and peace. You know, Demetrius, as I've always said, we have a very duplicitous language in the, that you speak with English, where a lot of times there are words, as you know, with the palindromes and all these different words that we did when we went to school, you know, with words that sound alike, different meaning, different spellings. And this English language that we speak, when people are using peace, peace and peace, prayers and praying, we have got, you know, we get confused with it. And when people use those words, I have to stop and pause and ask them to explain themselves to me, because I always go for the most negative aspect of it. And that's why I always tell people, I don't want you to pray for me, because I don't know which one of the two you're going to be doing. Because this, what they're doing over there, you treat, and what these United States are doing, because what, for one thing, Palestine over there in the Gaza Strip, they have a waterway, as well as from what I've been reading and researching, they have discovered oil out there in portions of the Gaza Strip where the Palestinians are. So now we could see, understand why the Israelis could have orchestrated these children being kidnapped, or they could have even have been, the murder of these children could have even been done right in Israeli territory, and they end up being dumped on Palestinian territory to give a green light to go ahead, because they've always not wanted Hamas to be a part of the Palestinian Authority, because you see Netanyahu foaming at the mouth. Everyone is Hamas, 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 because they figure it's going to be a problem. Now that Hamas is there, they have been on the move because they wanted to destroy that nation, steal more territory, and especially if there's oil and fresh water and everything over there where these Palestinians are, this is more reasons for them to go ahead and go full outright with their ethnic cleansing, with this ground invasion that has been, that they have done now, calling up all of these reserves, of which one of your favorite people, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, you know he's a member of the IDF that's out there, as I've said before, these people of Israeli dual citizenship that are the highest level of government that we have working in these United States, and they're also a member of the Israeli government. They don't serve in the United States military, but they're always on retainer to go and suit, get suited and booted to go and do the dirty work for Israel whenever they get called up to go out there and do it.
But, let me just ask you a question, ma'am, based on what you've said so far. I mean, this situation is very untidy. We know that. And
yes,
I wouldn't go so far as to suggest that Israel kill these young boys and put them in the, you know, in the Palestinian community in order to have an excuse. I don't see that. I think it is quite possible, because that's the nature of the existence there. It's been tit for tat for a long time. It possibly has been an unsanctioned, I use that word in the context that we know, an unsanctioned act by somebody just acting on their own. But nonetheless, I just don't see that as an Israeli ploy to begin the process at all. I don't think Israel really needs an excuse. Waged a violent war, and it has been given the green light, as you say, internationally, but particularly by the United States, to do whatever it wishes to do.
Disagree with you slightly on is that there's been a pattern of, in warfare, where people don't mind sacrificing one or two if they know it's going to get international attention.
Right, but I'm saying don't conjecture. Don't make your theory fact.
I'm just throwing out ideas out there, because everything that I've looked at and I've looked into, you three, we have to look where the background of these three children. What were their parents into? What were they in opposition of the Israeli government? Were they in alignment with other things where they were in opposition? These are all factions that we need to flush out. And as you've been an investigative journalist and a lot of these who are still on the case, who still do this good work, this is not what you're seeing in the media. They are turning out that these children were kidnapped, they were done these things. Because you only have to look at the King David incident that happened with the formation of Israel back in the 1940s, where they blew up that hotel. There have been a lot of times where Israel has seen that if we can do internal sabotage to ourselves, blame it on others, it's not going to get exposed until years down the line, And then we can get the justification right now and there in order to go ahead and get our objective in place. It has done, it has happened. The United States have done it. A lot of countries have done it, where they have sacrificed one of their own in order to get their broader sacrifice, which brings me into this situation with this Malaysian airline and what went on yesterday, where this plane was shot down. And now they're trying to blame the Russians and saying that it was a Russian rocket, but it happened on Ukrainian airspace and Ukrainian territory where this deed was done. I go back with that incident, you treat with what happened with the Malaysian, that Malaysian aircraft that said 23 Americans were on board. That, again, I can say, I can see it could be, we don't know what these 23 Americans were, what their backgrounds are, where they were heading to, what industry they work on. This is something we're going to have to flush out in the coming days to see if maybe this was a plot to get one or two individuals on that plane. So, okay, 295 people going to suffer because we want to get one or two people off of this plane. Because we don't really and truly, because this is atrocious behavior you treat, because as I said, the BRICS nation, you know the BRICS nation, Russia, Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, mm-hmm. they came together and they formed that bank where they agreed to put $2 billion in the bank. $1 billion up front, the bank is going to be in Shanghai, and that happened a couple of days ago before this incident, and with $100 billion to back them. So it's a $200 billion deal that was put together. Cutting out, you know, the fiat currency of the Rothschilds and the international bankers and all of them, they've been cut out of this deal. So now we can see why these incidents, things are being ramped up on epic proportion. The president might not know because we know there's a shadow government in Washington, D.C.
Sarah, you way, I mean, serious conspiratorial mode today.
I put a whole lot
And I love the way everything fits so seamlessly.
Yes, ma'am. I've been trying to go a bit extemporaneous, go out there, but like I'm
and this is extemporaneous yet. My Lord, what would happen if you actually had time to sit down and write this thing out?
I know, Eutrice, but like I've been saying, Eutrice, with this, we've got to look at all of this because in every little conspiracy, all it needs for a conspiracy is more than one person to come together, and we got a conspiracy going.
We have got to keep tabs on these things.
We have to keep tabs on these because this is atrocious, Eutrice, to see that these people on a plane, that here it is, you're 5 miles above the earth flying, and a rocket could come up from and shoot this plane out of the sky, killing all of these 295 people on board. We are looking at a potential World War II,
But we still don't know. I mean, I find it very interesting that they decided right away that this was as a result of being shot out of the sky, as Vice President Biden said. We don't know. Is it possible that there was a bomb planted aboard this plane? And, you know, what was the reason that this plane actually fell out of the sky? It's the same thing with the Malaysian flight that nobody knows where it is. And we had all these experts telling us day after day after day about all kinds of things except where it is.
They don't know where the plane is at, Eutrice, because as you said, this plane left from the Netherlands, Schiphol. This is right where that so-called underwear bomber came from into the flight to Detroit. Who is controlling that airport security out there? Because the last time I checked, it was an Israeli security defense force that was controlling the airport in the Netherlands. So we don't know if they, as you said, they could have planted a bomb on that plane, because that plane flew a very long way from the Netherlands. It got into Ukraine airspace miles away, a few miles away from the Russian border. What if it could have all blown up, or it could have been shot up from the ground from a rocket? So now that they can blame the Russians and escalate tensions more again between those two nations out there, because we know the Zionist faction is in charge of the Ukraine right now. They're in charge. Biden's son is sitting on some board over there to control the gas and the minerals over there in Ukraine. So this stuff, Eutrice, is getting out of hand. I want people to pay attention to the news. Don't get distracted with none of these other foolishness, because they have a way of burying information in the news by distracting you with entertainment, sports, and all kinds of foolishness. And we are not paying attention to foreign policy because it's undermining us and putting us in very unsafe positions.
Okay, well, that's That said, we have much to ponder today from the conspiratorial Sarah from Dallas.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Sarah. But really,
you
said quite a bit there that really needs to be, you know, we need to keep tabs of these things because they do matter. We still don't know. I'm not satisfied. You know, we found all kinds of military people coming forward and say, yes, we even saw it on our highly sophisticated satellite systems. We saw the launching of the rocket. And okay, great. We saw all of that. That's wonderful. But still, I'm not satisfied that the cause of this plane falling out of the sky, as Biden put it, is absolutely known. Thanks so much for your call today.
You're welcome.
From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you on this wonderful day?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
My pressure's all worked up now after listening to Sarah. I was gonna sit here and just calmly talk about what I wanted to talk about, but she got me all.
Invoke Harvey now. Now you need Harvey to bring you back down, bring us back down, calm us down. Connect with that black hole in each atom of your body.
There is a plethora of different events going on to talk about. So I wanted to kind of jump around a little bit. I don't know if you don't mind. First, I wanted to mention to Harvey, my fellow California resident, about an article that I went back and reread about the universe. Scientists, well, this came out in early 2013. I don't know if he knows about it, and Harvey and other people want to look this up, can go on Google and look it up. It's just that they strongly believe that the universe itself may be a computer simulation, and that as crazy as it sounds, they've been running tests to find out if it's a computer simulation where we may have been thrown into it or voluntarily been go into it to live our lives for some purpose, and then once we die, we go back to being whatever being we were before. Some are theorizing that.
So the Matrix is really true, huh?
Right, exactly. Some are theorizing that maybe the human race evolved to a point, they went through something like a die-off or almost destruction, and then they developed this computer simulation, so people of that, you know, hundreds of years from now, what we think now is, can go back and experience human life the way it was and do it right this time or do it better.
I'm completely lost, but that's all right.
You should just Google it, though. Scientists believe the universe is a computer simulation, and all these articles will come up. I mean, it was in Time, it was on Nova, all these other shows. So, anyways. So I wanted to also say a little bit to Sarah, her theory about the three Israeli boys. I'm like you. I wouldn't go as far as to say that Israel did that on purpose. But one thing I do know that was done on purpose was these little kids that were playing on the beach the other day were absolutely murdered on purpose. And I sit here and I think, you know, I saw some of the footage. I watch RT online, and they show things on TV that they don't show in this country. And it's horrible. I mean, three or four of these little kids were laying on the beach. I mean, their bodies just mangled. And then the rest of them, they had to rush out of there and take to the hospital. We know that was done on purpose. I mean, whoever had their finger on the trigger and did that had to get permission from higher up, and I wonder what kind of a human being can see little children, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years old, playing on the beach and just push the button and just kill them. I just wonder.
But you know, what is equally upsetting is that you would never know that within Israel there is a fierce opposition to the conduct of the government.
Right.
Many Jews are exceedingly disturbed about what their government is doing in their name, and they are opposed to it. But you wouldn't see those protests at all. You wouldn't hear about the mobilization of opposition to the government at all.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like here. There's a blackout on everything that's right, pretty much. I mean, they just don't want people to that movement to grow. So, you know, I wanted to just comment on that, and of course my sentiments go out to everybody in Gaza right now that are being bombed again, which this stuff really makes no sense. I mean, it's evil. So again, I'm going to shift gears again. Sorry. I wanted to elaborate. The last time I called, we were talking about what the political situation is and what I think we should do. And I wanted to recommend that people, I just started reading Ralph Nader's book, new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left and Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And it's pretty interesting. That's exactly what I was talking about the left and right getting together to try and solve some of these issues. And I think there'd be enough people for a really strong movement if that happened. I also still agree with your other caller that called that day about just not participating in this system in many ways. But I think people should read that book. It's a nice book.
Well, there are many issues. I'm seeing a lot of commentary. Increasingly, I'm seeing a lot of the commentary and observation about this left-right alliance, as it were. But I'm still bothered about the fact that the attention, I mean, there are some basic things that simply have not been addressed and apparently are not being addressed, and they have no intention of addressing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a safe bet to talk about the corporate sector and what it's doing. But we have some fundamental flaws here, and the left is so guilty of it. I'm talking about this issue of race. This is a question that they just will not deal with. It is just not even close to the radar. And this is a fundamental issue. Because it is at the root of so much of what's wrong. And the deliberate avoidance of it, to me, is a major flaw that we have to deal with. We have to confront that.
Absolutely, but it's not just the left, you trees. I know a lot of libertarians, and race is not their strong point as far as issues either. I mean, we have to confront that as well. I mean, that's going to be something that's going to stick out like a sore thumb, because a lot of these libertarians, you recall this Bundy incident. They're really upset about that because they're like, you know, the government encroaching on his property and all this. Okay, there's multiple issues there, like originally whose land this was and things like that. And also, a lot of people who are libertarians are white and they don't understand what it's like being another color in this country. You see what I'm saying? So that's going to be a problem as well. They don't seem to understand that most communities that are black and Hispanic around this country are pretty much almost like apartheid South Africa in this country. I mean, you got the police coming in all times of night, setting off sound grenades and busting in people's doors and shooting people for no reason. I mean, this is the thing. They get all upset when something like Ruby Ridge happens and all that. But, you know, these type of atrocities happen in our neighborhoods all the time.
And all the time. America, half of America doesn't really understand or know or is not familiar with what the other half is experiencing.
Exactly.
And this is a very important time to get that on the map, because it is the only way that people could appreciate how to organize a comprehensive response to anything that we could term progressive for the future. Thank you so much, DX, for your conversation today.
Have a great day.
You too. From New York City, Joel. You on the air.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air, Joel.
Good afternoon. I hope you're having a nice day.
Me too. I hope you're having a good day, too.
I am. You know what? I'd like to, if I may, just talk about a couple of things. The first is the situation, of course, that's going on in Gaza. But rather than talking about the minute-by-minute events that are occurring, I thought I would try to give a little historical perspective, which you never see on the mainstream media. It's always they did this, and we responded by doing that. But events are never placed in historical context. So I thought I would just do a little of that. And really, what we have to understand is that Zionism really is a kind of compulsion neurosis. Zionism emerged in the late 19th century at a time when the West was overwhelmed by all kinds of racist assumptions. The racist assumptions were the rationalization for late 19th century imperialism. When the Museum of Natural History was created, the first exhibit in the 1880s was on the cranium size of people who lived in the Southern Hemisphere, which was their justification for the relative lack of intelligence of Africans and Asians compared to Western Europeans and Americans, et cetera, et cetera. And when the first Jews in the first, what is called in Jewish history, the Aliyah, when the first Jews went to Palestine in a sleepy province of the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century, they thought it was uninhabited. They thought that it was a people without land for a land without people. And when Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann, one of the founders of Zionism, were there, Ben-Gurion told Weizmann that we have to get rid of these people. We have to move them into other areas of the Fertile Crescent so that we can have this land for ourselves. And Weizmann told Ben-Gurion, since Weizmann was dealing with European politicians at the time, had experience dealing with them, to keep his mouth shut, and we'll deal with this later. And so that's how the situation really developed. There's an extraordinary Israeli historian by the name of Ilan Pape, P-A-P-P-E, who was run out of Ben-Gurion University. I think he taught at Ben-Gurion, or maybe he taught at University of Haifa, now teaches at the University of Exeter, and is considered one of the deans of the new historians that have emerged in Israel over the last quarter of a century. And among other books that he's written, he wrote a book about 6 years ago that has never been reviewed in the New York Times or many other major avenues of opinion in the United States. It was called the Ethnic Cleansing of Israel. And he used only Israeli defense, IDF, the Israeli army sources, and defense ministry sources, so all primary sources. And he shows categorically that the Israelis were during the Nakba, the 1948 war, they were planning the ethnic cleansing of Israel then. We even know who was involved. We know the house in Tel Aviv where all of this was planned. I could go on and on, but there is this is not really a controversial issue, the issue of human rights in Palestine. The facts are incontrovertible and indisputable. We are dealing, unfortunately, with a society, and I've been there many, many times. I have 40 relatives who live there, 20 of whom are ultra-Orthodox, and the other 20 are secular, architects, lawyers, teachers, that sort of thing. I just want to say one other thing that you mentioned in relation to a caller who called a few minutes ago and spoke about the present crisis in Gaza. And you mentioned that there is a very large opposition to this kind of wanton violence that has now become state policy for so many years. And I would make some reservations about that.
Really?
A recent poll has shown that 80% of Israelis endorse fully the actions that are being taken now. And then the polls that were taken during Operation Cast Lead say the same thing. And the reason for that, I think, is shown in Max Blumenthal's new work called Goliath, which everyone should read who's interested in the subject. And that is that there is an indoctrination process that begins almost at birth. Unfortunately, most Israelis know very, very little about the reality, the historic reality of the creation of the state of Israel and the kind of proto-fascistic assumptions that have emerged as state policy over the years. And one last thing. Whenever a country becomes a national security state, and Israel is now a national security state, all of the same defense contractors that do such wonderful things here are in operation. They have, you know, defense contractors like Donald Douglas, Raytheon, General Electric, they're all there. When you become a national security state, it just seeps into the fabric of any kind of democratic value system that you have, and it corrodes it. So what we have here, I think, is a kind of tragic situation of the people who are functioning or being driven, I should say, by an ideology that is really supremacist. I think that the only way this is going to stop is if it stops from the outside. It's not going to stop from the inside.
Well, let me ask you a question about you said that you have relatives who are ultra-Orthodox.
Yes.
It is supposed to be a standard belief by the ultra-Orthodox that Zionism is anathema. Zionism,
correct.
But do they, at the same time that they oppose Zionism on religious grounds, since only the Messiah can declare Zion,
right. That's
do
right.
do they walk this interesting line where, on the one hand, for religious reasons, they are anti-Zionist, but on a philosophical side, they back the crazy actions of the Israeli state?
Well, that's a very important question, and I think the answer to that takes us back to 1967 during the Six-Day War, when Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, remember him?
Yes.
Went to the West Bank. He went to Jerusalem after it was captured and spoke to a lot of the ultra-Orthodox and immediately began to refer to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. And over the next 3 or 4 years, that kind of inculcation really came home, and there was a shift in many of the ultra-Orthodox now are settlers, and many of the ultra-Orthodox, you know, still feel that that Zionism as a secular ideology is anathema and is heresy, but there are many who don't. And in fact, the Army Corps now is filled with many, I wouldn't call them ultra-Orthodox, but they're religious nationalists. And there are religious nationalist parties in Israel that are to the right of the Likud bloc, or part of the Likud bloc, but even more to the right. I mean, they're just outright fascist parties. And there are many ultra-Orthodox in those parties. And I read the Haaretz Weekly, Utrecht, every Saturday. My Hebrew isn't that good, so I read the English edition version, and I specifically read it because I want to read the Knesset debates, and you cannot imagine the kind of scatological language, the racist scatological language that is used by many of these members of the Knesset, many of whom are ultra-Orthodox against Palestinians. They're referred to as vermin, as insects, right on the floor of the Knesset. So what we're seeing, I think, is a nation that is driven by a kind of monomaniacal ideology based on racial supremacy, and we're seeing many of the institutions of the Israeli state turning into fascistic institutions. That is one of the reasons why so many secular Israelis are leaving, and that is what is really freaking out the elite in Israel now, and that emigration is greater than immigration. In fact,
I want to return to your observation about the opposition by the people. And you're saying that the most recent polls are showing that 80% of Israelis favor the
enthusiastically. Some want even, in fact, Netanyahu was criticized in the Israeli press this week for taking his time in bringing about a landed invasion. And believe me, the mass Israeli dailies wouldn't say this if they didn't feel that the people who read their papers feel this way. And as I said, there's a mass education campaign that begins in early childhood and that continues right through high school. And there are many, many historians and essayists. I mean, if you read Amira Haas or you read Gideon Levy, who are courageous journalists who write the truth for Haaretz, which is sort of their equivalent to the New York Times, they write about this all the time.
But still, there is evidence that there is growing opposition very vocal opposition, because many Jews are beginning to question the stark similarity between the policies of Netanyahu and of even invoking a comparison with Adolf Hitler.
Sure, but it's not a mass movement yet, Utrecht. It really isn't.
But it's growing. It is growing.
Well, it's growing outside of the country. The BDS movement is really growing in leaps and bounds. And I'll tell you something. I think it may grow. I think in a sense you're right. It will grow in Israel because as all of these massacres continue, because you know the corporate media can do just so much. They can alter the truth to a certain extent, but after a while it becomes too egregious to be altered. So when that NBC reporter witnessed those four kids being killed on the beach, there's very little that you can do to whitewash that. And I think that as the anger and the rancor outside of Israel, because I'm not talking about the Arab League now because these Arab governments are completely corrupt, but I'm talking about ordinary people all over the world, as ordinary people begin to rise up and say that this kind of vicious assault, irrational, vicious assault with its proto-fascistic underpinnings has to stop. I think it will affect people in Israel as well. And I think the BDS movement is really important. And people have to stop buying Israeli goods. They have to divest from Israeli investments. And they have to put pressure on international bodies to sanction the Israeli government, just as was done with South Africa. That's what will get Israeli citizens to put pressure. Because, you know, most Israeli citizens are like American citizens. They look at their pocketbooks. Really. By the way, I don't want you to take up all of your time, but I just wanted to say this quick thing about a cousin of mine who's a special educator who lives in Haifa. And she's a special educator. She's a psychologist, and she was asked to go to the largest settlement in Israel, Ariel, which is a settlement of 20,000 people. Looks like a suburban, Southern Californian town, and work there in a special ed, clinic. That shows you how advanced these squat settlements have become. And they offered her husband, who was an economist, a job in the labor department, offered her a home without a mortgage, and offered her a bulletproof car. She refused, of course, because she wanted to preserve her dignity. But notice what they did. They offered her incentives. And I think if those incentives get affected by pressure from the outside, the Israeli public will change. But I'm telling you, Utrecht, if you go to Israel, and I won't go there anymore. I've been there about 20 or 30 times. But if you go there, the racism, the racial supremacy is egregious. It's open. People aren't closed-minded about it. I'm not saying that there isn't an opposition. There's always been an opposition. But the opposition, by the way, can't be structured within liberal, so-called liberal Zionist assumptions. That's a contradiction in terms. That's why liberal Zionists say, we think people should be warned before they're bombed. Maybe they shouldn't be bombed, but maybe we should have the occupation. And, you know, they're always making these prevarications and exceptions. So in a state that is informed by its Zionist ideology, it's very, very difficult for people to take the truth. What happened to Ilhan Poppy was he was run out of the country. A distinguished story.
Well, thank you so much. What an extraordinary contribution today. Thank you very much, Joel, for it today. Thank you. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Utrecht, how you doing?
Good. How's life in Chicago today?
Oh, life in Chicago is just very, very dandy. Wow. How do I follow up with that? Because that was actually an excellent caller. I'm going to have to re-listen to that one again to get some of those names of those historians that that he mentioned. Because I'm very much of a historian buff, which basically kind of leads me to what I want to talk about with all the news that's been happening. I actually had some time to start Gerald Horn's book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm currently in the middle of it. And Utrecht, it is an excellent, excellent
book. It is an extraordinary book.
It is
an eye-opening. I mean, your jaws drop when you say, my gosh.
Well, and here's the thing, too. It's like Gerald Horn has now become into my historian hall of fame. Just by reading half the book that his first book that I've read from him, and It's very interesting. I mean, I put them on the same level. Personally, me, you know, some of the great historians that I've read, Howard Zinn, Dr. John Henry Clark, C.L.R. James, those type of historians. Because the thing about this book that and all the other books that I've read from the previous historians is that they form a consciousness among you to let you, you know, make you realize how important this history is. You know, it's not just, you know, reciting names, dates, and, you know, what happened. It gives you an angle of, you know, why particular things happen and how possibly some of these things could happen again if, you know, if we don't pay attention to these events.
And when it comes to Gerald Horn's books, you notice, I'm sure that you have with this particular book, how well documented and annotated his book is.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing about it. I mean, a lot of the historians that I've read, they've had well, you know, documented books. Well, some of them have. But the thing is that the way he presents them, you know, and puts it together into a format where, like I said, you start to form a consciousness about it. One thing that I have been, you know, like I said, I'm only halfway through the book. And there are two actual books that I've been thinking about as I'm reading this book. There's one book that I read a couple of years ago called The History of Black Catholics in the United States by Ephraim Davis. And when Gerald Horn was talking about the role of Catholicism within, you know, within the context of the colonies and the Spaniards and the French, it kind of made me go back to thinking about that book, because one of the key points in Ephraim Davis's book was how Africans used Catholicism as a form of politics to get out of slavery. Because the one thing about Catholicism before the takeover of the United States was Catholicism was basically a separate type of, you know, political asylum for Africans. Because the Spaniards, when they baptized, you know, slaves, most of them became free, and they were not in the context of, you know, chattel slavery. It wasn't up until the formation of the United States where Catholicism basically integrated with the United States society, and then it became an issue because, you know, originally Catholicism at one point or another was against slavery up until they integrated.
Catholicism was the reason for slavery.
Well,
it was in the name of the Pope and God and whatnot that Ferdinand and Isabella said to Columbus, go to the New World.
Yes,
you have our permission. Whoever you meet there is worthy of death. You can just bring back the goodies
in the name
of the Lord.
And you know, I'm not saying that it didn't participate, but I'm saying in this short period of time during the colonial period that Catholicism actually was used to get out of colonial slavery. Because, you know, as Gerald Horn had stated in his book, you know, most of the colonials were basically Protestants. And, you know, we had a basically Protestant versus, you know, Catholicism type of war going on during that period of time. And another book that I thought about when I was reading this book was a book called The Rising Tide of Color and Against White Supremacy by a guy named Lothar Stoddard. He was basically a racist eugenist, but he wrote an interesting book in 1920 about how even the Europeans was going through some sort of race war during that time, because Lothar Stoddard basically, you know, tagged the Germans as the pure, you know, the purebred, basically the ideology the Nazis and Hitler used as, you know, as far as them being the pure Caucasoid race. And he generally talked about how, you know, some of the other races in Europe was actually tainted, you know, like the French and the Spanish were more Mediterranean, you know, and not of, you know, pure stock blood. And I thought about, you know, this period of time where the colonials were, you know, going up against the Spaniards and going up against the French, you know, in this, you know, basically war for the new world. So it's interesting because, like I said, when I start reading this book, you know, you start thinking about other books that you've read and kind of tie it all together. So.
Well, it's good that you got into Gerald Horn's book. You have at least another 30 more to go.
Yes, actually I have been, you know, the next book that I'm going to read is Negro Comrades of the Crown.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yes, I want to read that one.
That's a recent one as well. That's a recent one of his books. But the thing is, I appreciate the fact that he pulls no punches and he makes the correlations much, much more easily understood by giving you a sense of, you know, very often we see history as something that is extracted and you look at it as if it's an entity unto itself. What he's masterful at doing is giving you, you know, all the different scenarios that are operating all at the same time and the relationship. You know, the context is a dynamic one. So you get a sense of the evolving nature of this history that you're reading, that it is not just one thing and, you know, you snatch something out of a context and you look at it and then that's history. No, he says that's why he in this particular work, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, he relates the struggle in the United States with that going on in the Caribbean. And you see the relationship between the two, how one influenced the other. So that's a phenomenal talent that he has as a historian.
He does. And I'm interested because he did mention that his next book was going to be on the Haitian Revolution. And
right.
I'm interested.
He did say that on the program here, yes.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see what's going to be the difference between his book and C.L.R. James's book, The Black Jacobins.
See how that's
different and what
well,
he
they
can
both
add
are,
to it.
They both are very left of center. They both are Marxist in orientation. C.L.R. James was, and of course, coming from Trinidad, my country, he was pilloried, by the way, as a kook, a guy who just, you know, was out of his mind for the way that he saw things. But of course, now that he's safely dead, he's warmly embraced as a visionary.
Yeah.
When he was alive, he was not a visionary. He was a thorn in the side of the post-colonial era government. But I would tend to think that they share a similar view. But we'll see. I mean, it's a good thing. He did mention the book. I know he's working on it, and it would be interesting to see what he comes up with. But, you know, Gerald Horn is one of the hardest, like James Brown was the hardest working man in show business. Gerald Horn is the hardest working man in the history business.
Every time
you look around, there's a brand new book. And I don't mean one of those little pamphlets. I mean a proper book, 300 and 400 pages of book.
Gerald must not be married. He must not be married.
Well, I don't know about his marital status, but I do know that just about every time I've talked to him, he's been in a library somewhere.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. He must not be married, and I know he doesn't have any small kids.
Well, everybody does what they can do to contribute to, you know, the knowledge base, and certainly as a historian, he has done a great deal. And also what is important, you know, he is a very fine lawyer. He doesn't talk about that part of himself very much, but he is an exceptionally gifted attorney. But history is where he parks his car. And it's a good thing because it has derived for us so many benefits already in the many, many books that he has produced.
Yeah, I really appreciate
it. Well, let me ask
work.
You now, what's going on in Chicago? The last time I talked with the folks at the Chicago Teachers Union, I talked with the director of political programs there, dealing with the issue of the school closings. But there's a rumor that Karen Lewis, who heads the the Chicago Teachers Union, might be making a run for the mayor seat. What are you hearing?
Yes, she has an exploratory committee out there to find out what are her chances to win, because apparently by one of the Sun-Times, this local paper here, media poll, that Karen Lewis would defeat Rahm Emanuel, not by much, but they would have they would have her pegged as the winner if the election happened, last week or something like that. But I think what is happening here, and I think I came to you before about the other unknown candidate, Amara,
yes,
who's running as well, because also too, Tony Preckwinkle, who was also she's the president of the Cook County Board President. She was rumored to, be running as well, but she basically announced that she was not running for mayor. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of torn on this because, I mean, I like Karen, but, you look at this and you look at some of the other black candidates that are running, and basically her coming into it might hurt the chances of Rahm losing than it is winning, unless all the black candidates just get together and say, hey, let's support, let's just have one person run and then we'll stick with them. So,
she has a distinct advantage in that she has about 35,000 members of that union, and she has sympathetic support at availability. So she may be encouraged. But I think, though, that in the end, she is an educator at heart, and maybe that's where she sees her, her future being in the field of education, and she's so passionate about it. So I think she might be torn about that.
Yeah, and I think so, too. And like I said, I like her ideas and everything, but I think the problem is that she still has too many political enemies in Chicago, whereas with, like, say, with Amara, she's relatively unknown. So nobody sees her coming. So I think if they got together and just said, hey, look, we'll just have one person run, and then we'll support you. Because I'm pretty sure if Amara gets the backing of the Chicago Teachers Union, she has a very good chance of that.
But the question is, what does she walk in the door with in terms of running a city? Are you there, Henry? Oh, we lost Henry? Did we? Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay. Well, I'm so sorry about that, Henry. You were in the middle of answering the question and we lost you. But at the same time, we're close to the end of our program, so I might as well sum up things right here. I want to thank you for bringing your best thoughts to Free Your Mind Friday, because it is a forum, and you would not imagine how impactful your observations are. People listen, and it expands people's minds, and this is a really great benefit. It allows people to think things and rethink things, and the exchange of information right here, we are each other's teachers, and so I value this time spent together. Stay tuned. We are going to be offering next Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, coming right up right after this program. And of course, always feel free to just, drop me a note, tell me how you think the programs are going, and let me know what impact it has on you. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. And with these remarks, I bring this program to an end, and thank you so much for your participation today and your profound thoughts, sharing them. That's a great, great blessing to us all. Have a great weekend, and we'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye.